We're going to discuss goodwill and impairment. I give the floor to Tim.
Thanks, Hans. Good afternoon. So the main purpose of session is to discuss the staff's ideas on disclosure, so to provide some better information for business combinations. And Wong He will take us through that in a bit more detail, but before that, I'd like to go through agenda paper 18A. So 18A basically summarises the various ideas that the project is exploring to meet the objectives that were set by the board in July. And paragraph 3 sets out those three objectives: improving disclosures, simplifying the subsequent accounting for goodwill, and targeted improvements to the calculation of value in use. And then table 1 in paragraph 6 analyses the ideas that are being explored to meet those objectives. So those ideas are disclosures, reintroduction of amortisation, relief from the mandatory annual quantitative impairment test, removing the requirement to use pre-tax inputs in calculating VIU, and removing the restriction on including enhancement or restructuring cash flows in calculating VIU. And the analysis considers how those ideas will meet those objectives, and in some cases actually it could hinder those objectives. And it considers those objectives under some broader headings, so better information, reducing costs, which is essentially simplification, but also improving the effectiveness of the impairment test. Now, in July, the board decided not to do any further work on the headroom approach, but we think some of the ideas can actually contribute to improving or affect an objective of improving the effectiveness of the impairment test. And so that those impacts should be taken into consideration when selecting the ideas to support in a preliminary view. So the board at a future board meeting is going to consider its preliminary view or views, if it does have one, that it wants to express in the discussion paper. And it will consider these interrelationships between the various ideas, and it will need to consider what's the best combination of ideas that meets those objectives overall. So before I hand over to Wong He to talk through the disclosures, there's no specific question in this board paper for the board, but the staff will welcome any comments that board members have.
Thank you. The comment made by Tim was very important. Actually, the objective is better information, reducing cost, and reducing cost again. But the objective underlying here, in this three objective, we still have to pursue the issue of improving the effectiveness as a package of this project, because we have not given up the addressing the issue of too little, too late issue. Too little, too late issue is somehow underlying issues. Although we gave up improving the IS 36 with having having a headroom approach or something like that, we gave up. But we haven't given up that addressing too little, too late issue. So as Tim mentioned, so this objective may affect in selecting all these preliminary views. So that is the point you raised. And one concern about table is, if you just look at the table on the paragraph 6, we cannot see that kind of overall objective, because this table only talks about the reducing cost and simplification and the better information only. So I think table 1 itself is okay, but underlying objective is to improve the effectiveness. So that could be improved a little bit.
And Xiao.
Thank you, Hans. And I agree with staff's analysis, especially the table 1, really helpful. Just one observation with regard to the better there are better disclosures for business combination. What's the objective? What's the benefit? I think it's really, if we improve the disclosure further, actually it's helpful to improve the effectiveness, because the company need to disclose more. That means we'll add more discipline on management with regards to forecast or calculation, something like that. So I think this is the main benefit. But the wording included in the table one, on page three, we say that secondary benefit improving effectiveness. What here included is that those information on subsequent performance could provide auditors with additional information to challenge management's forecast. I think first they could add discipline on management with regard to those forecasts or subsequent performance, something like that, not the auditor. I think we're not help auditor to challenging those management forecasts, something like that. Even we help auditor, just help auditor to confirm or assess those management forecasts. So I think the wording need to be a little bit careful to illustrate what's the benefit with regard to the better disclosure we'll have. Yeah.
Nick?
Thank you, and I appreciate this is an area where the board has made a decision previously, but it was tax words of better information and reducing costs that piqued my interest. And I'm still rather confused why we have chosen not to address the issue of the treatment of other intangibles. There is strong and consistent views from investors, from starting from 2008, when investors met at jointly FASB and our own board, to describe this as a retrograde step in terms of IFRS 3, treatment of these other intangibles. EFRAG did a study with 40 investors in 2014, same message. Crough responded to an EFRAG document in 2017 saying that this information was subjective and unhelpful. Only yesterday someone raised it with me in an outreach meeting. Practitioners say it's very hard to value these assets. Companies don't really see the value in doing it, it costs them. And I just, in terms of our commitment to evidence-backed standard setting, I'm just really struggling to see how we respond to these ongoing concerns. You know, it, to me, there seems to be a win-win opportunity here to provide better information and reducing cost. Is this something within perhaps our next document where, given it was in the PIR and raised in the PRI, where we may ask a question of constituents?
I mean, certainly the in terms of the objectives that the project was originally set following the PIR, it did look at intangible assets that may need to be or could be subsumed within goodwill, and it was considering some of the things that you talk about there about subjectiveness of the valuations. They're quite difficult to value some of these intangibles, and some questionings over the value of actually separating those out. And that was something that was an objective for the project, which subsequently the board then decided not to pursue further. But the intention is to refer to that within the discussion paper. So there will be an opportunity for stakeholders, if they think that that's an issue that actually we should be addressing, then they can discussion paper on that basis.
Yeah.
thank you, Tim and company. A really well-written set of papers. It's very easy to read and so on. But don't take that as I agree with everything that's in there. But I do agree with a lot of it. But keeping the comments on 18A, and I'm on the table one, just a few observations in it. In the first section, better disclosure, secondary benefits, I'm not so sure external disclosures are really a huge aid to auditors challenging management's estimates. The information's inside the company. I mean, in vastly greater detail and granularity than is going to be in any footnote. So without necessarily saying that's an erroneous comment. I don't think it's a critical one, because I think management has to support their impairment analyses, which ultimately the critical number in any of these things is the sales forecast. Because ultimately costs, they think companies tend to understand their fixed and variable costs. So you got to kind of know what the top line is, and from there, and then you sort of work way down into cash flows. But I mean, I don't know that how an external disclosure would help. I mean, you can always do a look back, looking at the internal records as well. Next thing, reintroduction of goodwill and reducing cost, a subject near and dear to my heart. But I do appreciate under the secondary benefits, it begins with the word if. I think these are separate issues. Reintroducing amortization is separate from relief of the mandatory annual test. I think they can coexist together. They could neither exist, one or the other exist. I just don't think they're linked as much as you do. And just for the record, you know, going back over decades on the subject, the amortization varied 20 years, 40 years, but depending on which standard setter and which period of time you looked at. But there was two other follow-on comments in that same this requirement that's often overlooked. It should be amortized over its estimated effective life, not to exceed 20 years, 40 years, or whatever. And they're always still subject to impairment test. Granted, as they amortized down, it, in theory, it got easier. There always was an impairment test there. So even with we reintroduce amortization in one fashion, I still expect there'd be an impairment test. And then on the same section, objectives hindered by the idea, reducing costs, that it make the point that it perhaps is a little bit more cost to users to either add in a line for amortization or eliminate a line for amortization. And I don't discount that that's a real phenomenon you're talking about, but under the theory that weak arguments dilute stronger arguments, adding a line or subtracting a line is what analysts do. And you've got adjusted earnings in there. So again, it's something, but I don't know that it's a really major driver, you know, towards where this goes. Thank you.
Okay.
Actually, just before we move on to paper, just on a couple of the comments. In terms of that, where you just raised my attention to out, mentioned it as well, in terms of the improving the effectiveness, the better disclosures improving the effectiveness, it could provide auditors with additional information. I think the staff's thinking was it just makes it more transparent about where the objectives of a business combination aren't being met, that actually that is something that allows the auditors to maybe challenge why there might not be an impairment at that point in time. But the other aspect, which is what Qing Zhao actually mentioned, is it's possible that it also, and this is something that actually is in Agenda Paper 18C, paragraph 23, I think it is, and I think this is a CMAC member, they say that it might actually also create an incentive for management to monitor the business acquisitions more closely and promote better governance. So it's possible you might get some benefits from that. But an overall comment, which is those secondary benefits, they are second order benefits. And in some circumstances, they might not necessarily be there, and they could be minor or slight. So,
but under the theory that weaker arguments don't take away from stronger arguments. I think this is too prominent of a chart and there's not enough total words on it. That's all.
Yeah.
So again, I'm not necessarily disagreeing. I'm just saying I don't think they're particularly helpful.
Okay.
Okay, let's move on to the disclosure paper.
Yep.
Agenda paper 18B, we would like to ask for your comments on the staff's ideas for improvement to the disclosure objectives and disclosure requirement of IFRS 3 to meet the project objective set by the board in July 2018. Just a reminder, in the July 2018 meeting, based on the key findings from the research work, the board decided to pursue exploring whether disclosure could be improved to enable investors to assess more effectively whether a business combination is a good investment decision and whether post-acquisition performance of the acquired business meet the expectations set at the acquisition date. To help develop our ideas, since October 2018, we have conducted a number of outreach with diverse stakeholders, including the meeting with board consultative groups. So for your reference, Agenda Paper 18C provides a summary of the feedback received from the board consultative groups, and this feedback has been incorporated into the idea presented in this paper. And as explained in paragraph 13 in the paper, the staff's recommendations are intended to strike a reasonable balance between the information needs of users and the cost of providing this information. And paragraph 16 sets out a summary of the staff's idea. First, improving the disclosure objective of IPAS-3. Second, providing additional disclosure to assess whether the key objectives of the business combination have been achieved. This is about subsequent performance information. And third, making targeted improvement to the sum existing disclosure of requirement of IFRS 3. So let me briefly explain improving the disclosure objectives of IFRS 3 first. Our suggestion is to propose two key changes to the disclosure objectives of IFRS 3. Firstly, making the existing disclosure objectives of IFRS 3 more clearly and specific to help preparers to understand why this information is needed for users. And secondly, adding a new disclosure objective of providing the information on subsequent performance. So moving on to the additional disclosures on subsequent performance, as explained in paragraph 29 in this paper, we think providing this information would help users to assess management stewardship and management ability to generate the value from the business combination. But as Tim mentioned before, we also think this information might help users to assess whether the expected benefit of the business combination have reduced, and therefore it might have a secondary benefit of compensating to some extent for limitations of the impairment test. But given the great variety of the different business combination, we think this information should be based on how a management monitors and measures whether the key objectives of the business combination have been achieved in its internal reporting. We think this management approach has some merits, such as providing robust information and minimizing the cost, as described in the paragraph 34 in this paper. And as shown in paragraph 40, we ask the stakeholders for advice through outreach to help develop our idea further. So based on those discussions, our suggestion is also that the subsequent performance disclosure is based on those business combinations monitored by the chief operating decision maker as defined in IFRS 8, rather than being required for all material business combination. And this information should be provided for the reporting period in which the business combination occurs and for at least the next two annual reporting periods. Moving on to the third idea, which are targeted improvements to some existing disclosure requirements of IFRS 3. As set out in paragraph 68, we suggest three improvements in this paper in response to the feedback received. First is the amount or range of amount of expected synergy arising from the business combination. Second, separate disclosure of any liabilities arising from financing activities and pension obligation assumed on acquisition. Third is, in the year of acquisition, the amount of acquired revenue, operating profit or loss, and cash flow from operating activities since the acquisition date. However, as explained in paragraph 69 to 70, other than these three improvements, there are further possible changes to the existing disclosure requirements of IFRS 3, which can be dealt with after the discussion paper. Other additional changes could include the removal of some existing disclosure requirements in IFRS 3 if the information they produce is not useful to reduce the cost and the preparedness. Regarding other disclosure part, depending on the decision taken by the board on the other project objective, the board might need to consider additional disclosures which have not been discussed in this paper. And then we also consider the disclosure of the amount of the equity, less goodwill and certain intangibles. We think there is a link between this idea and the decision on whether to reintroduce the amortization or not. So we propose that the decision on whether to support this idea be deferred to a future meeting when amortization is discussed. Then paragraphs 116 to 119 set out the staff recommendation to improve the disclosure objectives and disclosure requirements of IFRS 3. I'd like to emphasize that our recommendation for better disclosure in this paper will be just one part of the various ideas that the board will consider at a future meeting in deciding which preliminary views, if any, to express in the discussion paper. So our question for the board is, do you have any comments on the staff's idea for improving disclosure?
Thank you. I agree with the overall direction of travel here, and I like the proposals to focus the disclosures more on the business combination as a whole, if you like, and sort of less explicitly on goodwill, because that's, you know, our logic as opposed to investor thinking. And so I like that sort of general frame of reference. A couple of other specific thoughts on your proposals. I like the move in theory towards a sort of more improving the objectives and trying to make them more specific. But given that we are aware that preparers are a little bit reticent about providing some of this information from a commercial sensitivity perspective, etc., I think we should put as much as we can in here to sort of try and encourage good behaviour rather than boilerplate type information. So, for example, in 117B, I agree with this idea of looking at the key objectives of the business combination, and I agree that we shouldn't be too specific about what we think the information might be, but I think it would be good to find a way to emphasise that in order for this to enable investors to understand what's going on and to form a frame of reference for disclosure going forward, when they meet this objective, we should be encouraging it to be sufficiently specific that it enables that type of analysis to occur, and also encouraging them to be quantitative. Because I liked one of the examples you had earlier in the paper, I can't remember where the paragraph was, where the sort of information you thought you might end up getting provided was about the sorts of sales volumes you might have expected as a result of the acquisition. And I think to be confident we get that sort of outcome, I think emphasising that it's quantitative might help with that. I quite like your idea of using the CODM as a sort of frame of reference for thinking about which business combinations to focus on, although I know that there's a certain level of investor frustration with the quality of what comes out of IFRS 8, so I'm a little bit balanced on that. I wondered whether it would be, if we get information provided about the things that the CODM focuses on and that's missing particular business combinations, I think that has information content in itself because it suggests that management's not really focusing so much on those business combinations. And I wonder whether a disclosure of the business combinations that are excluded from the analysis might in itself be a useful piece of information, or whether we think that that's obvious enough, but that context might be helpful. And the last thing I wanted to comment on was a specific suggestion in 119B about the liabilities arising from financing activities and pension obligations, and there was a bit of an analysis in the paper about whether that was too rules-based and should we be embarrassed about that. I don't think we should be, because I think if there's a particular piece of information that we think users are, you know, really going to want, more likely than not, let's be clear that that's our expectation and not be worried that it looks like a rule, because I think the benefits for investors justify it.
Gary?
Thank you. And I actually liked a lot of what's in this paper, but most of them will tell you is probably what I don't like. But it is a long paper and is well done. I think, starting to just go in the order of the paragraphs, I think paragraph 20 about preparers needing to understand what users need. Quite frankly, I think they very well understand what users need. And I think to imply that preparers don't, especially those who have investor relations departments and the capital markets activity, they know what preparers, what users need. They might not want to provide it. You might want to try to play dumb, but they very well know. They know what analysts are, sell side, buy side credit. They know what they're after. In it. So I don't, again, I wouldn't build that to a big point in it. Is the, because first of all, I would find it annoying. I said, well, you don't know what users need. I said, well, you know very well what users need, but wanting to provide it something different. So I would write it in terms of if you went this route, why should you provide it as opposed to you don't know what they need? So that's just a thought. Jumping through the paper, I think. So you're, in some of the disclosures, you're going to get boilerplate in here, the strategic need. It'll probably, if it's in the line of businesses that you do today, you probably it's going to be to expand market share or something like that. If it's something totally unrelated to what you've been doing, I think the need for strategic discussion gets progressively more important in it. But I think we do run the risk of some boilerplate, and we got to kind of work that issue as this project develops. I think on paragraph 42, we're talking about material versus super material acquisition. I think we stick with material. Material is hard enough to define, much less super material in it. I think on paragraph 44, about what the CODM would look at, I think since we're talking about presumably a couple of years of disclosures, you know, of incrementality, what they're looking at in day one might be very different than looking at in day three, especially as the thing gets integrated and gets pushed down into operation. So again, I'm okay with this, but I don't think we should assume it's evergreen and permanent, yet, quite frankly, on that. I think on paragraph 46, there was some concern about asymmetry between acquisitions and disposals. I don't think that's a concern at all. I think they're both M&A activity in one sense or the other, but I think they're very different, and I wouldn't be concerned if the requirements were asymmetrical or not. I think comes up in several places about synergies, the amount of synergies. I think disclosures of synergies is very much tied into the integration strategy. If something's not going to be integrated, there's not going to be a lot of synergies, at least I don't think. You know, there's always some. So if you buy a public company, buys another public company to be standalone, well, the chances are the target's investor relations group and corporate treasury group is going to be gone, you know, but not the operations. On the other hand, if you're buying it for operational synergies, the cost savings is often paramount in how you price the deal and so on. So I think they're, and especially if you're going for a shareholder vote, you're going to advertise these synergies in your prospectuses and so on. So I think it's tied to integration, and if it's going to be integrated, I think disclosures in some fashion synergies are entirely appropriate. How you measure them, I don't know, you know, because it's, you know, the best laid synergy plans change starting the hour after the acquisition closes in it, but we should try to go for it. And anyways, that comment sort of permeates a number of the things in here. I think when we get to disclosures, when you talk about a management approach, I think it should be expressed in terms of an objective, and it should be some measure of incremental contribution. And I would suggest to keep it to revenue, some measure of profit and cash flow. What's available and ready to do on, say, the first year or the first reporting period, if it's different, is integration plans take time. They don't occur, you know, quickly, you know, if it's any sort of complication in it. So what's available early on might be different later on. So I think you'd keep it objectives, that the objective of the disclosure is to communicate and disclose a measure of its incremental contribution, in my sense, revenue, cash flow, and profit. then you start giving examples of how that might be able to be done. And again, I think it will vary from company to company, but ultimately ask the question, if you have a real material acquisition, even if it's integrated, you're prepared, the share AGM or the press conferences, how's the acquisition doing? And an internal answer is developed for it. And it's not going to, it's going to be more than, well, it's doing well or it's doing bad. And the answer is, well, how much does it contribute? You know, and I think it's going to be hard to go much deeper than an objectives because information is kept differently. And what's available on day one might not be available, you know, 2 years later and so on. And again, someplace in here, we talk about pro forma, which to me, I take that as kind of restating back as if it did occur. I wouldn't do that. I think that's very problematic. And if that's the case, we should reintroduce pooling, which I'm not advocating, but in effect, that's what it's doing. And that was thrown away for its defects. You know, it would still be true. I could go on, but that's enough for now.
Tom.
Yeah, I'd just like to pick up on what Gary said a little bit about synergies. Is when you, and also that you say it's arbitrary. I mean, if I look at IFRS 3 and the basis, they went back to talking those 6 points in paragraph 313 and 316. And they used that thing that FASB used and we used to basically split the acquisition price into two things. One is just the write-up of the assets. The second is goodwill. And the third one is over-under payments. The goodwill, they split in two. The internal goodwill of the acquiree as a standalone plus synergies. So synergies in that sense has a very precise and measurable thing. I'm sympathetic to what you said because in the process of the acquisition, the measurement can be muddied if it's a very long process. The measurement's very clear if it's a very quick process because you can just use the price of the acquiree the day before you announce, and that becomes the internal goodwill. So I thought it was kind of a good point to think about synergies, and that might be a good place to start because I don't think it's totally arbitrary, but that if you flesh out this idea of synergies against that those paragraphs, and then talk about where the problems come in. And in that regard, I'd cite two problems because synergies have a clear meaning for a lot of people. And what I just described is a mathematical difference, what you paid versus the standalone fair value of the thing. So that's a mathematical exercise. It may not accord with people's view of what synergy is. And I can think of a couple of places where, even setting aside that there's no over-under payment, if it's a disciplinary takeover, is that really a synergy? Like, you have really stupid management, we're going to take you over and you know, create some wealth. It would be in that fourth tranche. Another one would be, suppose you had a capacity reduction takeover, the industry is oversupplied, we're going to take out the smallest brewer, shut the most inefficient plant. It is kind of a synergy, but people might not see it as a synergy. So I think it's a good way to go, but I would avoid the use of the word arbitrary and maybe explore how people could talk about synergies, possibly anchoring in those paragraphs.
Anne?
Thanks, Hans. I support the direction that you're going with the paper, and I appreciate how you're trying to do it in the ways that you've proposed. I am sensitive to the preparers telling us that there are already a lot of disclosure requirements, and also the notes in the third paper showing us what GPF said about this. So while there are extensive disclosure requirements, we also know that there's levels of non-compliance with them. So looking, since this has become effective, looking over time, it's interesting that the disclosures around M&A haven't really improved, according to the empirical research, whereas the disclosures around impairment have actually become more, the range of disclosures has become less. So there's more compliance. Compliance is higher on IAS 36 over time, and there's less diversity between countries. And that's absolutely not reflected for M&A for the IFRS 3 M&A disclosures. There's as much diversity as there was. It hovers around 70 to 80% compliance in studies. So 70 to 80%, depends where you stand, is that good? It's the bit that's missing, though, because there must be quite a bit missing if we hear what we hear from the users about this. The research also tells us there's a lot of diversity between countries. So there are some countries where the compliance is much better than in other countries. And given that we're international, that's something we have to be concerned with. So I think it's a big challenge for us because the disclosure requirements exist already, and we've heard that sometimes the responses are boilerplate. So our challenge is improving those disclosure requirements. So I appreciate what you're trying to do in specifically looking at which ones can stand alone and be improved by making them sharper. Because we also know that the enforcement agencies have been looking at these disclosures over this same entire period. And when I see graphs that tell me they have the area of IFRS 3 hasn't improved and the diversity across countries is still there, it would look like we're not seeing the solution we might expect from the activity of auditors or the activity of the enforcement bodies. So hence we are looking at it, and so I appreciate that you're looking at it. And even though it looks like a hard ask, in the sense it's hard to change the words and change the requirements and get a behavioural change, I think that is what we need to be doing at the moment. So high-level comments. On the specific things, I'd just like to touch on CODM, and I recall the kind of feedback we got in IFRS 8. And there were two particular things that I want to refer to because I think it needs some thinking about. One of them was the whole issue of who is the CODM and the approach in the US about who the CODM is, one person versus the international approach where it's more likely to be a board or a committee. So there's this whole issue around who it is. And then the other thing that came out a lot was our use of the word review. So the feedback is that there are people that can circumnavigate or circumvent, if I could use that word, circumvent the requirements of IFRS 8 around this word review. So I think we have to be aware of that as we're planning this approach, which I do agree with. I think this approach is worth pursuing. But it seemed that some of the intention of IFRS 8 was not achieved because people took issue around this word review. And we were told that these days it's not a matter of reviewing. People duck in and duck out and they get bits of information from their dashboard that they want. And so there was a lot of playing around the word review. So I just bring that up now because I think we have to think. I support this approach through the IFRS 8 idea, but I think we'll have to think about how to operationalise it better.
If I could jump in there, I think, Anne, we can certainly think a little bit more about that. But to your second point about regularly review, I think there's sort of a natural control in the system because, to Sue's point, if the CODM is not reviewing something about an acquisition, that's going to look very questionable. So unlike the other situation where the argument was, well, I don't want to disclose this particular segment, so I might try to play around with it. It's a little bit on the flip side there. So there might be a natural control, but we can think more about it.
Okay.
Nick.
Thank you. So in terms of the proposals, in terms of the subsequent performance transactions, I support direction staff are going here. I began in quite a dogmatic place here, and now I welcome the pragmatism of the approach and that the metric can vary from one entity to another and indeed from one transaction to another, which I feel is entirely appropriate. I do think it's important that the state where you don't monitor the subsequent performance of your deals, that a statement is made that you don't do that because there's a lot of information in saying that. So I think that's a nice package together. And then turning to the targeted improvements to the existing disclosure requirements, so thinking about the economics of transactions as they occur, I was quite enthusiastic about what was happening as I read the paper, because for a long time I've had this jigsaw puzzle with lots of pieces missing, and you were gradually giving me the missing pieces, and I'm ticking them off. And then at the end, you took away the top right-hand corner, and I've still got this incomplete jigsaw puzzle, and it's useless being an incomplete jigsaw puzzle. And the piece you've taken away is the pro forma information. And I go back to the 2014 EFRAG work, where, just to quote it, users found pro forma information very useful. However, there were a number of concerns about the presentation of pro forma information that often varied in practice, and its presentation could be improved. So people put a great deal of weight on this information. I'm not convinced by the alternative proposal that you have in the paper in terms of providing information since the deal was closed. Acquire a business on the last day of the financial year. What kind of? I know you try and provide ways around that. I'm particularly worried where a transaction may be a part of vertical integration. So you're acquiring a supplier or a distributor. So simply adding up the sales of those two makes no sense, because you need to work about, you know, what's the lost sales through that transaction as you vertically integrate. I also notice in US GAAP, the requirement is still to provide 2 years of pro forma information. At the moment, we only require a single year. And this seems, again, a weakening of those requirements. And so it is. So I'm having this jigsaw piece missing kind of undermines the other information to some extent. And I think will leave users very, very frustrated. I'm not sure how costly it is to produce this information. If it is just about cost savings, you know, I've got a source where you can find lots of cost savings in terms of, you know where I'm going with this, or I won't mention it, but I'm not a buyer of the cost angle in that respect, and say users put a high value on this information. It'll be a difficult sell for us.
The reason we came up with this solution is during the PIR of IFRS 3, we have received many comments from stakeholders which suggest the removal of this performer requirement. But while performing our list additional outreach, we have identified a clear view of users why this information is needed, especially performer information is needed, and then whether especially the PEREP BH64Q2 is provide the relevant information. So that's why we are struggling with.
I think there's a difficulty with the existing requirements. I accept that, and that they ask for performer information on revenue and profit. The profit is not defined. And so often it gets provided at the net profit level, which I can see could be expensive because you're having to work out what the finance costs and tax would have been if you had acquired it for the whole period. And actually, users aren't interested in, they want the something akin to an operating profit number, which you have in your paper. So that may be a source of cost savings in its own right. If I look at the notes from CMAQ, that I did see support there for pro forma information. CMAQ wasn't necessarily clear on what parts of pro forma, but there was support there. But again, the EFRAG study seems to be very strong support for it.
Yeah, I mean, just to respond a little bit further, I think certainly in the PIR, there was a call for some guidance on exactly what was meant by that pro forma information. I mean, in the requirement, it talks about as though the acquisition date for the business combination was at the beginning of the current reporting period, and it's not clear exactly what the standard means by as though, what is the basis of that, and there's need for guidance for that. And I guess what the staff's idea was trying to do in terms of looking at the information post-acquisition is to give users an idea of the contribution of the acquiree to the group's revenue and operating profit and operating cash flows post-acquisition, and some other information if necessary to enable users to come up with a reasonable annual forecast of what the contribution will be on an annual basis, which users could then use for comparative purposes, and also gives them an idea of what to expect to see. And I guess, yeah, depending on how you define as though for the pro forma information, what's not clear to us is exactly what is it that the historic pro forma sort of hypothetical information gives users more than what we are trying to provide them with.
I think that's the phrase you're trying to provide them with. The words seem to me to be far too loose to ensure that users will get that information. That's and so the pro forma seems to be a much more defined request.
Yeah. I would throw in a note of caution there, though, because the pro forma requirements don't have a lot of specificity in terms of how to define, or not just define, but how to calculate what the pro formas look like. So in your vertical integration example, it could be the case that companies are just adding things together, not necessarily accounting for the loss of revenues. So there is that risk that the pro formas might be giving a sense of greater meaning than what is really happening. And this disclosure instead would be a little bit clearer as to what it is we're trying to represent.
But potentially incomplete.
That's fair.
That's and perhaps the answer then is try and be more specific in the words around the existing pro forma requirements.
Yep. And then from you mentioned cost, and from a cost perspective, I think in terms of that cost, it really depends on what the guidance says, but if that guidance would require the pro forma information to restate to IFRS and restate to the acquirer's accounting policies and maybe apply fair value adjustments across a 12-month period, then that starts to be where preparers would have to provide that information just solely for that disclosure, and that's the additional cost, I would say.
I assume preparers may have a fair idea of some of those numbers already in terms of analysing the transaction before they completed the deal. Not necessarily all of them, but some of that information I'd hope would be at their fingertips.
So you think the benefits are pretty high? Like the costs might not be insignificant, if, you know, that would be what preparers might say, but you're saying the benefits for investors are pretty...
That's certainly the feedback we see in my experience, yeah.
Mary?
Overall, so supportive of the direction, but let me make a couple comments. One is, when I step back and think about it, I think one of the messages I take away from the PIR and all the follow-up we've done is that investors are standing there screaming at us, we want to be able to understand whether an acquisition has been successful. The information that we're getting does not allow us to do that. And I step back and say, well, I think we were kind of relying on the impairment test to do that, because if it wasn't successful, you'd have an impairment. And I think there is some value, and we continue to see. I'll save my comments on the value of the impairment information for another day, but I think I've reached the conclusion that even if the impairment test is done wonderfully, it still is a very, very limited information in respect of that significant objective of investors. So in terms of what you're proposing here, I think saying we're going to deploy disclosure tools specifically to get a better response to that objective is the right one. And I think further that you're doing the right thing, which says let's first focus on the disclosure objectives and being absolutely clear that the objective is the objective of the disclosure requirements that we will set out is to allow users to assess the success versus the original objectives of that disclosure. I think then that your proposal in here is that we allow preparers to do that using a management approach, the same kind of approach we use for segment reporting. And I had some hesitation about that, kind of doubling down on the management approach, when there's been continued messages from users about their concerns about the usefulness of segment information. But I think if we are specific enough in this regard, we can overcome it. We can also maybe, as Anne was saying, learn some lessons from what we've heard about segment reporting. And I think one of them we kind of touched on before, and maybe Anne who said this, which is rather than saying, if you monitor this information, then provide it. We're saying, no, the objective is you must provide information that allows somebody to assess. Now, we'll allow you to do this with information that's prepared on the way management, views it or monitors it, if you have the information available that way that will allow you to. And that's why you have to say, oh, we don't monitor, the success to kind of get out of it, as opposed to you just have to disclose what it is you look at. There's a nuance in the expression, but I think it'll be important that we tie back to the objective, which is you have to give people enough information to understand whether it's successful against the original objectives. Now, before it starts sounding like we're going to write a requirement to add a book about any significant acquisition to, you know, to the financial statements, some of it is things that I think we have to change or improve in terms of the existing disclosure requirement. But to the extent the problem is with compliance, we shouldn't always be the ones who have to do this, you know, to try and cure with standard setting something that is a compliance issue. So I think maybe we have to pull out some of the things we've heard about where the compliance failures are, whether it's geographic or a particular area or something, and try and highlight those and raise those with responsible parties, because that's not the stuff that we should try and fix with standard setting. Standard setting is costly and disruptive for everybody, and if it's a compliance issue, we should label it and try and address it that way. So I think deploying the disclosure tool to supplement the impairment tool is the right answer. I think focusing first on the objectives and making the objectives very clear is the right approach. And then we should think about, you know, and I'm okay with trying to ease the burden by allowing it to be done using a management approach. But I don't think the management approach is the get out of jail card for satisfying the disclosure objective. And I think one of the things we should learn from our experience with IFRS 8 is even when we take a management approach, we could think about saying, but at a minimum, you have to provide information about X. We don't do that in IFRS 8. You know, we don't really have minimum line items. And that's one of the things we've been pushed to consider adding. And so I think we should think about some of the things that you have in this paper, you've covered in this paper, like what are the factors that drove the setting of the price? And, you know, maybe even saying, identify whether it depended on, and not list everything possible, but three or four main things like cost savings, growth, access to, you know, research, technology, or markets, and how, you know, how you were going to measure them. Just, you know, giving some examples. And then the last thing I'd like the staff to think about is long ago and far away in the days of, what was it, IAS 22, we had, and I think there's a parallel in US GAAP, a requirement to provide in the financial statements a reconciliation of the historical cost balance sheet of the acquired entity to the kind of acquisition accounting for the entity. And I think, should we go back and look at that? The major cost, to my mind, in that is that you have to get the historical pre-acquisition balance sheet on an IFRS basis. And if you're acquiring an entity that hasn't reported on that basis, that could be a challenge and a cost. But it would answer the what is the amount of debt, pension obligation, et cetera, acquired. It would give you some data about what the acquisition, you know, the fair value adjustments are made as a consequence of purchase accounting. And Nick, that might be another way of getting some of the, you know, some wouldn't, okay.
Sorry.
I know, no fun. But, you know, I'm not saying I think I have concluded that we should do this, but I'd like you to think about what information came from that before and whether there's anything we should think about again based on the experience with having dropped that disclosure requirement. So that's my other suggestion in this area.
What's Raza?
Like others, I support the direction that you've taken. I think the objectives that you set for the additional requirements fit well with the objective assigned to those disclosures. I have a number of small concerns, nevertheless. I know we've said that we didn't want to undertake a review of the IFRS 3 disclosures, but I fear that we may face pushback for good proposals just because we are not putting them into the full picture and because we are not taking this opportunity to question what are the current disclosed information which are not that useful. or that are not considered as, you know, necessary to support the assessments that users have to make. So it's, you know, I mean, I was struck by one of our GPPF members saying that, stop saying that you improve disclosures. Just tell us that you're adding some. So I would favor that we take the opportunity of this consultation. It's going to be a long consultation. There will be a number of investor engagement so that we question how to rationalize what we have. Maybe what the idea of that Mary just gave, maybe a way of doing that. If we don't, as I said, I'm afraid that we're going to encounter a position that otherwise we would not encounter. And finally, I would join Anne on the reservations about the CODM. I wouldn't want this to be to fail the meeting the objective that has been set just because it wouldn't work. And I understood, Nili, your objection and saying, I mean, that if they don't have anything to offer, they're going to look like fools. But still.
Mm-hmm. Would you be okay with what Mary had suggested, that one way of doing it is through the CODM, but if that's not going to satisfy it, you have to find some other way?
I guess I would prefer another way. One that is not, you know, suspect of having failed. Mm-hmm.
Following on Françoise's remark on cost, I have a very low cost proposal. I see in paragraphs 109 to 114 that my ideas for a disclosure of equity without goodwill meets very little enthusiasm. So I would like to give an alternative, which is a subtotal of tangible equity. Reasons, it's something that is already used in the markets by banks, by regulators. Why do they do that? Because there are problems with measurement of intangibles, so it's good to give people a special look at it. These are also assets that tend to disappear into thin air when a company gets into a lot of trouble, so there are reasons to give extra care when evaluating assets like that, and to also have a view on what is the equity position just in case it all disappeared into thin air. And it would also give perhaps some comfort to the many people that do think that goodwill should be amortized over time, and it's very I don't think it's very likely that we will go there in the end. We still have to have the discussion after the discussion paper, but in case that we wouldn't go there, then I think this would provide at least some comfort to those who think that ultimately that position should be reached. It's low cost, and it could also be a good legitimation for reducing other parts of the cost of the impairment model that we have now by, for example, reducing the frequency of the impairment test. So that is something that, for these reasons, I really would like to be considered. Proposal like that in the discussion paper. I know for all the standard setters and ASAP, et cetera, they all say, yeah, it's easy to find, especially when we introduce a line item for goodwill. Well, a lot of investors are not all that sophisticated. And I think to have this subtotal, which could also be introduced in models for automated trading, I think that could be helpful to solve at least a part of the problem. So even if there's little enthusiasm, I think it is really worthwhile to put it in up for a discussion in the discussion paper. Gary?
Thank you. He had a number of comments, but I wasn't thinking about responding to yours. I didn't know it was coming, but actually, I agree with that. That's worthy of proposal. This is a discussion document. I think the co-op is worthy of discussion. Effectively, you're saying for on face of the balance sheet, a line item that basically is consolidated tangible net worth or something like that. And again, might debate what intangibles besides goodwill go into it. Maybe the indefinite live non-amortizing ones, yes. Maybe the identified amortizing ones, no. You know, in fact, sometimes those are the most valuable assets. But again, whether or not this would survive the entire due process, I think it's worthy of asking the question. Actually, I think you'd get certainly not unanimous. I think there'd be support in the preparer community for it, particularly if the impairment test went away or got modified in some ways. In fact, you could argue, putting aside presentation, I effectively have netted it against equity, and therefore I don't need to impair anything and I don't need to amortize anything. I've already got an equity number that eliminates that. I think that would be the feedback coming. Do I still have to do these other things, or is this the stop at presentation, or what else do I get for it? And that be no impairment or no amortization or something like that. But anyways, I think it's worth putting out there. Anyways, to the comments I wanted to make. I'm trying to put myself in a former life where I'd be throwing stones at a lot of these proposals. Now I'm trying to say, how do we avoid those hitting us? And how to make it better? I think, talk about who monitors it. Every acquisition is monitored. But not necessarily by the CODM and not necessarily as an intact unit. So it's sort of, I think when you look at, and I'm really talking about acquisitions that are largely integrated, standalone ones, it's a different story. But I'm also assuming that whatever disclosures we're going to make, you're looking to have them for at least a couple of years worth of them, but not in perpetuity. So those sort of ground my comments. I think we would first thing try to decide how many periods do you want. I think you get a different answer if it's stewardship is my focus, and that might be a longer period of time versus I just have the disclosures until all periods presented on the same basis. I think that's a decision we got to make, and that would argue maybe it's 2 years, maybe it's 3 years, but it's no more than that. And again, if you're a foreign private issuer, it might have 3 years of cash flow in the P&Ls, and if you're not, it might only be 2 years. So your period of time may differ. But if it is such, all periods are presented the same basis, it's a different, arguably it's a different answer than if stewardship, which might go longer. I think whatever proposals we come out with is, there's got to be a degree of flexibility in them such that the kind of they live as the company lives. There's information that's available on the last day before a company is acquired can be very different that's available 3 months later or the next reporting period later, which can be in turn different still from what's available a year later. Companies are dynamic, and the day one CGU might not be there very long. If you bought it to be integrated, if you take a vertically integrated target that's bought, your manufacturing may be hived off and put inside your manufacturing group. Your distribution may be absorbed by the parent's distribution operations. The sales force may get broken up, or you start, hey, we each got some of the same customers, let's put them together. And to the extent that we can recognize that the ability to cost effectively get this information can change over time and sort of make our disclosures flexible to accommodate that change, I think we'll go a long way towards getting preparer buy-in. Again, going back to, if you still want some measure of its contribution, I'm into revenue, cash flow, profit, but you might get there in different paths over different periods of time. The other thing I think we need to reflect in here, it's sort of consistent with that, is likewise is targets are broken up, CGUs change as well, and much of the impairment model is linked to the CGU concept. So should we ask for guidance, how would you change the CGU? At what point is it relevant to break it up or to move it escalated further upstream in the company? Again, all sorts of things can and do happen. But right now, in large measure, the impairment test assumes CGU is something of a constant. But in fact, if you break up the operations, will the CGUs get broken up by, because they're basically just an end byproduct of everything else. And then, I don't know how to deal with this one, but sometimes you buy companies not necessarily for immediate P&L opportunities. And so what do you do when the measure of success is something other than monetary? So a good example could be you spend a lot of money because some research company's got a very developing drug that's entering stage 3 of FDA trials. So you go through stage 4, which could be 10 years later, there may be very little revenue, but you're betting a lot of money that you've got a knockout drug that's coming. So what is the success measure during that period of time? You're not counting on revenue. You're counting on phase gates through the prescription drug processes and so on. And that may vary by country where it stands. So again, I'm using that as an example of there's going to be success measures other than what's shown on the face of the income statement.
Tuck.
Thank you. First of all, the Hans idea. I think it's, in a sense, a good idea to provide information to the users and make it prominent. And I think it's worth exploring, but there is a lot of difficulty. So first of all, we are saying that the goodwill is an asset. However, it is a kind of shaky asset, which is different from tangible asset. So we are going to segregate it from the tangible asset. Then the balance sheet should be balanced. So how would you make a debit credit entry, or would it part of the present face of the financial statement or just disclosure? If it's not disclosure, then how can we present? So that affects a lot of our other project disclosure and the PFS. So there are lots of hurdles we have to overcome, but because it's a discussion paper, so I'm personally curious what kind of reaction the users or our constituents have. So that's the one point. The main point I want to discuss is about the disclosure. I totally agree with what Gary mentioned. Actually, when you acquire the individual...
But your comment about debits and credits here...
Yeah, so if you want to make it on the balance sheet,
yeah. So
then you want to... Basically, you want to show it, deducted from equity.
No, it's just equity before. So it would just be as I should change
just
nothing
line.
About
okay.
What goes in the balance sheet or not. It would just be a subtotal before equity and subtotal called tangible or equity before tangibles and intangibles and goodwill, and then you would have intangibles and goodwill, and then you would have equity.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. No.
Yeah, but it's difficult in the American style balance sheet. So if it's a kind of narrative balance sheet, it's somehow possible. Yeah. But when you try to make fit into the balance sheet, it's a little bit difficult. You can put it outside of the balance sheet as a supplemental information. Then it's okay. But the question is whether it's a disclosure or a part of the PFS. But of course, we are free to discuss. So it's interesting. By the way, my point is disclosure. I agree with what Gary said. So when we acquire entity, it is integrated into the main operation. So in a sense, it could disappear on day one. So and actually, when we listen to the preparers, They are not really monitoring individual acquisition itself. They are just monitoring the budget of segment basis or operating segment basis. So therefore, even if we ask them to provide this consecutive subsequent performance for acquisition, actually they have to make it up. So that's the reality. And I am curious whether or not how important the information of whether individual acquisition was successful or not. Because in your paper, it is said users are very keen on information about each acquisition was successful or not. I think I understand, but is it really important for assessing the stewardship? In your paper, it is written, in order to assess the stewardship, you have to know whether the acquisition was good acquisition or bad acquisition. I understand that if your money was managed by management and then they bought they made a very stupid acquisition, it's a problem of stewardship. However, all in all, if they are running their company well, so in this sense, they are achieving their stewardship in a totality basis. Because I remember we have discussed in the ASAF meeting, and that the friends from Australia talked about the shop in London area, and that they picked up the example that they bought a one entity which is operating in the center of the London. And then the performance of that entity is not really good. Does not provide good cash flow as they expected. However, because they purchased that operation, total operation has been improved. And then they think it's a success of business. So question is, I really like management approach, but if we too much stick to the individual acquisition and try to provide some quantitative information, I think it doesn't really hit the point. So maybe if we go to the management approach, we should be more flexible than the individual acquisition. And I hope we can persuade the users. Individual acquisition does not necessarily mean the connecting to the assessing the stewardship.
Yeah, so just to respond to that, I mean, it was always, I think, the staff's view that this is not necessarily about the acquired business itself, the acquisition itself. It could be wider. And where there's integration, or where in the example that you're referring to, there's actually a benefit elsewhere within the business. The success of that acquisition would need to be thought about on a combined basis. Mm. And so it's not necessarily just thinking about the acquired business in isolation. And that's what we would expect in terms of what's the appropriate way to monitor that type of acquisition. And in terms of what do users use this information for? I mean, we asked that specific question in the CMAC session last year, and the feedback was that it was for stewardship. Although there were certain CMAC members that said it was also for valuation purposes, it gave them a better idea of the valuation of this new part of the business that was coming in, but that it was for stewardship purposes in terms of in future proposed acquisitions, will I as an investor trust you, the company, with my money, that you will invest it in the right places and realise the value from that. So from that sort of stewardship perspective. But that, to your point, that doesn't necessarily mean it's just about the acquired business. It could be a wider thing if it has a wider impact in the overall business.
Osraza?
Basically, I didn't comment on paragraph 109 that you say is your proposal, largely because in paragraph 114, the staff told us that it was not the time today to discuss it, but it would be discussed at a later stage. So, silence didn't mean no support. Silence meant discipline following the staff directions.
Thank you. I generally agree with the direction recommendation here. But if you got some kind of approval by the board of the of this all your recommendation later, please clear the interrelationship between the existing objective and requirements with additional objective and additional requirements. It seems to me there are maybe some kind of redundant, you know, requirement among existing and additional new ones. That's one suggestion. Another one is maybe many people have already suggested in the case of management approach, we are going to allow some kind of non-IFRS measures too, right? Like IFRS 8. So are you going to introduce a more kind of transparent package of a disclosure on that non-IFRS measures like in the primary finance statement, or just give us some kind of a full flexibility the management enjoys in IFRS 8. So you need to think about some kind of the options between these two, even though you are adopting some kind of management approach. That's another suggestion. The one final suggestion is actually the Hans idea. I guess this is his proposal is once in 8 or 9 years since I worked with him here, so it's very surprising. However, that's quite a peculiar, looks like a peculiar suggestion, but I guess that's a good idea, as many board members suggested. This is a discussion paper stage, so we can offer some kind of a special recommendation to our stakeholders. Because the reason there are many reasons, but one of the reasons I'm just proposing the same proposal as Hans made is we haven't to have had some developments in the recognition or measurement or presentation, except some kind of improvements in disclosures. So I think we have failed to improve the impairment test, because we couldn't resolve all kind of issues, difficulties in the head of approach. So everything is just related on the disclosure. You know, in that sense, until we improve our impairment test, maybe in 5 years, or if we can improve other recognition, measurement, presentation issues later, until that time, we need to highlight this risk asset is existing on the balance sheet. So especially non-professional users, you need to be very careful with this asset. We even trying to make some kind of a good, you know, good thing on this, something on that goodwill was impairment loss, but we couldn't make it. But until that time, highlight, you need to be warned, because this is very risky. That's the reason why I'm in with the Hans. There are many reasons. There are positive reasons. It looks like very, maybe not so professional suggestion to our stakeholders. But most of our stakeholders are basically professional accountants. They know everything. So that's why that their response, first response, is easy to say. We can pick up that number with the other numbers. We can make this kind of a project very easily. Why are you bothering with another? But We are not the users of this information. The outsiders, non-professional, maybe reporters,
politicians, you know, investors, they are our users. So that's why I'm saying this might be a stupid idea. I'm sorry, not stupid idea. Sorry, reasonable idea. Idea might be worthy of, you know, having some kind of a, you know, screening about some of our
speakers. Other people might think it
was other people.
I think you're near other the people. End of your term. of course, Tuck was right that my proposal could not possibly be a subject. It would have to be a disclosure. Stupid mistake. Tom.
Then again, it might not be a stupid idea.
Oh, no, okay.
I just want to support three things that came out with a couple of comments. I like Hans's idea. About the net tangible. I think if we do that, it would make a lot of sense in the management commentary to have a really robust, rigorous discussion of intangibles to accompany it. Because then what's happening is we're basically isolating the things that are hard to value. Yeah. And where do you talk about them? So it might be nice to couple that. The second one was just on Nick. I totally agree. And just what we heard the paragraph 91B, the pro forma, should be kept. We've heard a lot in the PFS that in fact, some of the MPMs are designed to deal with the break that happens at acquisition, and this helps. Also, I think we heard similar things in the BCUCC with respect to what they learned, so that pro forma probably should be kept. And then on Anne's thing on the CODM, and Gary, what Gary said is, what level of management? And I think clearly this probably needs to go lower. I think management makes sense, but a CODM is probably too high, because we already know the CODM, and I'll link it to just paragraph 50. One of the really hard things in this is you have the thing coming in, and you may have some standalone projections for it, but at some point it's going to be integrated, and there's a half-life to this integration. So sometimes it'll be integrated really fast, sometimes it'll take longer. And the point is, I think any entity would be foolish to keep tracking those initial ones once it's well integrated. So it's not just a time limit of 2 years. If it's integrated immediately, in fact, all the goals might be in terms of the integrated entity. My two soft drinks are now together, and here's our expected revenues, costs, et cetera, distribution, wherever. And they could highlight, we're expecting distribution costs to be way lower. And I guess that was my thing, is when you write it up, paragraph 50 made me a little bit nervous in that I think it's legitimate for entities to specify integrated targets for the combination as their goals, and to skip sort of trying to parse out which is which. And so I think we need to allow that's a legitimate way to go. But they should, if that's the way they go, then they do have to tell us integrated targets. And then if they do that, because there was a sense that if management does not monitor the business combination, well, what they're monitoring is the integrated entity from the get-go. And they do it by extension. And I don't want to be too, kind of go what Gary said about flexible. I don't think we should be too harsh, as long as they're giving us something that we can use to evaluate the combination. That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just very quick. First of all, I agree with staff's proposal. Overall approach, I agree. I think staff did a very good job of trying to develop a proposal how to improve the disclosure of the business combination. One thing, as Tuck mentioned, I think the paper actually addressed this issue very clearly. Look at the paragraph 51 and 52. Actually, the staff are aware that have difficulties that if those acquired business already integrated to the acquired own business, and also users mentioned that in this case, the information with regard to the combined business, not individually business basis, still usable, and the staff try to develop a proposal based on the combined business, not based on individual business. I think it's the right way to do so. My question is that at what aggregation level should it be allowed? If they combine all the business at the entity level, it's too high. I think the level should have some discipline. The level should not higher than or equal to the, you know, operating segments. If higher than or equal to them, because segment reporting already provide relevant information. They're also based on the combined business. So I would like to suggest provide some, you know, we are aware, and but we have tried to develop proposal, but provide some discipline or threshold on this kind of information disclosure. Secondly, I share with similar concern about the CODM. As I mentioned, I think we should aware this kind of how to make judgment of who is the CODM, and try to avoid too much, you know, flexibility to leave for the CODM to decide which information should be disclosed. I think in this case, materiality principle should still be applied as existing standards used. So I'm a little bit, you know, cautious about go to totally a management approach, yeah, in this information disclosure.
Peter. I'd like to comment on the interaction with segments. So, and this is really about which information to provide rather than about the aggregation. So if you imagine that the acquisition was big enough to be a single segment by itself, then if we did nothing more in this project, you'd be getting the segment disclosures subsequently. And presumably we would think that ought to be the information you'd need about the subsequent performance, or we would be making more improvements to the segment standard. So then the question is, if there is other information that you need, well, first of all, in that situation where it's a separate segment, is there extra information you want because you think the segment standard isn't sufficient, or is it extra information because it's an acquisition? Is there something about the fact that it's an acquisition that means you need more information? And then if you carry that thinking down to what happens if what you acquire isn't big enough to be a separate segment or is integrated into one or more existing segments, then I think the question is, do you want systematically more information than you would have had if it had been a separate segment? And if so, why, and what are the drivers of that? Or should you be aiming at the same level of, roughly the same level of information? And it seemed to me that probably it ought to be the same, and so it wouldn't make a lot of sense to put more boundaries about what type of information you provide than we put around if it was a separate segment.
It makes me a bit nervous that we're going to reopen the whole segment debate if we start doing that. I think it's something to think about, but I'd be nervous about entangling it too much.
Could I maybe add just one process thing, just reemphasize? You might already be ready to say this.
I was just going to try to summarise what I've heard.
one really quick thing.
You carry on.
Remind everyone of a point that Tim made at the very beginning. With respect to the May meeting, we will be coming back with a paper to ask the board what they would like their preliminary view package to be, if you'd like a preliminary view package at all. So with respect to Hans's reasonable idea that others may not think, that could be one piece of the paper in which we could say whether or not the staff recommends a preliminary view. Even if the staff does not recommend it to be a preliminary view, it could still be discussed in the paper. So I think that would either way would meet your needs, but we'll have to do some thinking and come back to that.
Okay. Well, I'll have a go. You might have to bear with me, and there's I might make a couple of comments along the way on some of the things that we've heard as well. But just to try to summarise what we've heard, and therefore the question was really about hearing your comments to help us think about the papers that we develop for a future board meeting when we bring back the disclosures as part of the overall discussion on the preliminary view. And so in terms of the things that I think I've heard, and I'll look to the team also to help me out here as well, whether I've missed something, that we actually need to give some thought to as to whether we when we bring back the disclosure paper, whether we put some more guidance in there or do a little bit more work. In terms of Hans's suggestion, as Nilly said, you know, and as Francois kindly pointed out as well, there was always the intention to bring this back at that future board meeting, because we do think that there's a linkage with some of the decisions that will be made on the preliminary review. And in terms of that particular idea, we can give some thought about how that might work as well. And so that will be part of that. There are a couple of places on different issues, but people mentioned the risk of some boilerplate information, and also Nick mentioned on the pro forma, or the staff suggestion on the pro forma information, that the language might be too loose and would it get the right answer. One of the things that we didn't actually put in the disclosure paper, because we were trying to focus the disclosure paper, and I think our intention was that would then follow on into the discussion paper. We wanted to focus on the key issues, and we didn't necessarily want to talk about a lot of other detail that was in our minds when we were going through the disclosure ideas. But we thought, well, actually, that's too much for a discussion paper. But this one actually is probably worth reiterating in terms of we were intending to have sort of either some sort of catch-all disclosure requirement or something within the solution that says, actually, once preparers have provided the information or prepared the information for users, they need to go back to the objectives and think about what those objectives were and have they actually met those objectives and have they provided enough information for users to meet those objectives, and then think again if actually the conclusion there is not. And there was some thought given to that, and we may well just re-emphasise that within the paper. Then I've heard a number of comments around CODM and some of the issues around that. And as a team, I think we'll go away and have a think about that as to whether we need to provide a little bit more colour to the discussion within the disclosure paper to think about some of these issues. And then just to give some thought, or whether we actually go more extensive than that and rethink about what we're proposing there. I mean, there are a number of people have said, well, maybe actually it should be at a lower level, maybe it should be all material acquisitions, maybe it's a lower level of management. The difficulties with both those things, and the sort of why we went with the CODM view, was taking down to a lower level of management, different organisations with different structures. When you use the word management, they all mean different things to people. You're talking about senior leaders, senior management, you're talking about the junior managers and the various layers below that, and it's quite difficult to actually work out what therefore then is meant by that in terms of a definition. So and in terms of all material business accommodations, I think we were thinking in the approach that we were proposing that if you take a highly acquisitive company that acquires a number of target companies in a given year that are all material, but actually from an executive committee perspective, if that was their chief operating decision maker, that maybe there isn't information provided to that, because actually this business is very capable of doing those types of acquisitions, and actually from that high level, there's a reliance on the existing team to incorporate those. We were concerned with where there is those numbers of acquisitions that actually requiring an entity to provide measures against all of those business combinations, it could become quite unwieldy, and that was why we thought actually striking it at the types of acquisitions that the chief operating decision maker actually monitors themselves seemed to, with us, strike a reasonable balance with that issue. But that was just where we are. But it's obviously something we've expressed their concerns there, and it's something that we will take away and have a think about. There were a few people that mentioned the deletions, looking at IFRS 3 more widely, and also looking at, are there possible disclosure requirements that can be deleted? As we said in the paper, there are some thoughts that we've had on that, but our thought process was we didn't want to go into all the detail in the discussion paper and in this disclosure paper. But there are things that are on our mind that we thought actually could be addressed after the discussion paper, once we've got feedback on the key issues. What did I have else? I think we'll take on board Nick's comments actually on, and I know Tom supported that as well, the comments on the pro forma information. I've sort of explained during the course of the meeting sort of the staff's view and how we got to that, but I guess that's something that as a team we can reflect on and think about how we then take it forward to the next board meeting. Let me just see about that. Peter, Monhi, anything else?
Sure.
Can I just make a comment on something that I'd like you guys to think about when we talk about this? So I understand the sort of desire to ensure that by focusing on disclosure that we don't go overboard in terms of ending up with a book of information about business combinations, which is why I think we've sort of been cautious in terms of where we draw the line in terms of how many business combinations that we ask people to provide information about. But I think we need to think carefully about why materiality isn't the right cut here when it's the right cut everywhere else. Mm-hmm. Because if I've got a company which does an acquisition once in a blue moon versus a company that does loads and loads and loads and loads of acquisitions, I think when they're stopping to think about what's a material piece of information, you get a different outcome in those two situations. And, for example, in IFRS 12, I think we've got requirements to provide information about, subsidiaries and associates and things, to provide particular information about them. And we rely on materiality there. Some companies will have thousands of subsidiaries, some will have very few, and we're asking them similarly to make these sorts of assessments about where materiality kicks in. And given that materiality is meant to make a cut where the information is something that we think investors should be receiving because it could influence their decisions, I think we probably just need to be a little bit careful that the cut that we're getting is really achieving our desires given that definition, and whether it isn't applied properly, the concept of materiality, already scalable. Now, I don't know the answer to that, but I think it would be useful for me to have that analysis thought through rather than going to a different approach to really assess whether it's necessary to do something special.
And that's certainly something we can give some thought to. I mean, in terms of that company that has just done a one-off acquisition for the first time once in a blue moon, you would expect their chief operating decision maker to want to have information on that if it's a material acquisition.
Yeah, I agree.
And if they don't want to have that information, i.e. they don't monitor that, I still think that is quite valuable information to users as well.
I think for us to use a different cut to normal, we need to have a good reason for why we think it's not going to work. And I think I'd just be interested to make sure I'm on the same wavelength in terms of the thought process, particularly because I don't think CODM is a sort of... We know it's not perfect because of the feedback mm-hmm. we've had on our website. So,
Tim, I just want to pick up on your comment that you think there might be other disclosure requirements in IFRS 3 that need revisiting, but you're not going to do it till after the discussion paper. What my concern is that people will focus on all these new requirements and preparers will see it as you're asking for more and you haven't taken anything away. So in the past, when we've talked about the whole project, we've said, well, yes, more disclosures here, but the trade-off will be there'll be some simplification in relation to maybe recognition and measurement or the application of the... So there was some give and take. But if people are focusing, now that we've said, well, we're looking at this and over then impairments over here,
there's a concern, I have a concern that people will just focus in on the disclosure and say, you just want more disclosure. And that we're proposing more disclosures without having looked at the bigger picture of IFRS 3. So I'm speaking then to Francois's point that in other fora we've decided we aren't going to do a review of IFRS 3 disclosures. But I think that we need to, as a board, to actually consider what else is required in IFRS 3 and what did we hear in the post-implementation review. So perhaps in your materials, if you could direct us to a source where there's a summary of what was said mm-hmm. in the PIR from the feedback on the IFRS 3 disclosures specifically, so that we can get a feel for what were the other sticking points preparers or users brought up, and that would help us as we try and push this forward.
If I can comment on that, because I think where the staff are coming from is that in October they asked you whether you wanted to do a more comprehensive review of the disclosures, and you said, no, let's make sure we don't get distracted by looking at other things. Now, of course, what we could do is do a more limited scope look for a few things we could cut out to make it look like a more balanced package. But I think that's inherently a bit difficult to do without really looking at the whole thing again as well. So I think that was the motivation behind the approach. But I think if we do go with the approach that the staff are proposing here, I think we absolutely need to give some signal in the discussion paper that we probably would look at the whole package of the disclosures in some way at the next stage.
Martin?
Yeah, also on that, because when that was discussed at the GPF meeting, and there was clear from preparers saying, okay, maybe we understand there is a need to improve on that, but clearly there is so much disclosure which is not needed, and then if we're doing that, we have to look at maybe we can also not require some existing disclosure and drive the right balance here.
Well, I certainly support what has just been said. What I said earlier, I think I would not suggest that you do more work at this stage. I think we need to go out with this consultation. But we can do, I mean, we can show that openness by asking questions and directing our outreaches to gather this type of information. And if it is apparent in the discussion paper that we have these windows open, I think that's a way of showing that the final outcome may not be for the worse. And that's also a way of picking up Nick's question that, by the way, relates to Hans' suggestion. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of openings. We are at discussion paper stage, so we can reframe the scope of what we do next out of that new input that comes will come 7 years after the one on which we rely.
Yeah.
I think just to be aware, and you already know to emphasize it, is that the more we highlight additional things that we could take on, the more we raise expectations in the market, and then the more time we'll need to sort out and proceed with models through everything. And that may be the choice that you'd like to make, but just bear in mind that it all takes time.
Can I just respond to Neely? Mm-hmm. I completely take that on board, but this is the third PIR, and this has got a lot of attention on it. So we need to demonstrate not just that our process, but that, you know, some way PIRs work. We hear, and there is response and there is balance. So,
yeah, just there. Then.
Okay, let's take a break till 3 o'clock.